Jesus said to the 12, "A disciple is not above the teacher, nor a slave above the master. It is enough for the disciple to be like the teacher, and the slave like the master. If they have called the master of the house Beelzebul, how much more will they malign those of his household? So have no fear of them, for nothing is covered up that will not be uncovered, and nothing secret that will not become known. What I say to you in the dark, tell in the light. What you hear whispered, proclaim from the housetops. Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. Even the hairs of your head are all counted. So do not be afraid. You are of more value than many sparrows. Everyone, therefore, who acknowledges me before others, I will also acknowledge before my Father in heaven. But whoever denies me before others, I will also deny before my Father in heaven. Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have come not to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And one's foes will be members of one's own household. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever loves a son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Those who will find their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it." So we'll have a lot of fun with that one. And now that we've established that nobody in this room, myself included, is worthy of anything godly, we can move on from there. But first, that passage that Veronica shared with us in the Gospel, not the Gospel according to, the book of Genesis. As I mentioned last week, for those that were here, we're going to be receiving on Sundays serial readings of various parts of the Scriptures. Right now, from the book of Genesis, that's eventually going to head into the book of Exodus over the course of the summer. Same with the gospel reading. We're going to be hearing passages from the gospel according to Matthew. And again, as you folks have heard me suggest, it is very difficult, if not impossible, to really understand what's going on when, from Sunday to Sunday, we take these passages right out of their context and say, "The gospel of the Lord." It's like, unworthy, all of you. And off we go with our tails between our legs. That's not what's going on here. And so we're going to have some conversation about that. So I just wrapped up two consecutive three-year terms as a member of the board of FISH. And I'm proud of that service on behalf of St. Peter's. I mean, I think, or I hope, with my wicked little sense of humor, we were well represented. And it was a real joy to work with the other members of the board. And no doubt, Marietta and I will continue to be involved with FISH in a variety of ways. We were there last night at Glen Eagles for the annual fundraiser, and some of our own came for that fabulous meal to support FISH. In the meantime, I was thanked for my time on the board and was given this. Now, let me get you the full effect here. There it is. Sure. If you promise to be careful. Now, the women who were in my class on the board were given flowers. And I was presented with this. And I have to tell you folks, at first glance, I was kind of speechless. I didn't quite know what to say until Jim Peckham, the executive director of FISH, explained to all of us that this was made by one of his staffers, a young woman named Devon, who works with client services over there, wonderful young woman, who is also a very creative arts and crafts type person, who both designed and made this. And it's what do you call this? The trophy or the gift or, you know, the send-off, whatever. Pardon me? An object of art, thank you. Yeah, it is. And Marietta and I had a chance to chat Devon up, and she was so proud of this and so excited to be asked to come up with something interesting for Father Jeff as he goes off of the board. And I don't know if you can see, but we will pass it around. Of course, fish, something coming out of the fish's mouth. I'll leave that up to you. There's another little fish with a wiggly little tail. And then you may see loaves inside and outside of the globe there. I also began to notice, after I moved beyond my speechless mode, that it sets on a plate and the feet are napkin holder. The point, there's symbolism going on here. I mean, Devon put her heart and was paying attention to the mission of fish, which is to help people in crisis in some very particular ways, and made this out of her understanding of the mission of fish. Is that wild? I mean, is this cool or what? Yeah. I mean, plate, napkin holders, and bread. And she even fired the loaves of bread. I mean, you could do the whole loaves and fishes thing. You can go in lots of different directions with this. She made those herself by hand with her toaster oven or something. I mean, she got pretty creative with this thing. And the whole point is that you can look at this and contemplate it, which I have been doing all week since it was presented to me, and you can go in a million different directions with this fabulous piece of art, right? And that's my point with the readings. Here, Jack, take it. I don't think it'll bite you. It hasn't bit me yet. That's my whole point with these readings. You can listen to these, you can come back to them, you can read them over and over and over and over again, which I have been doing for decades, and come away with different things every last living time, and can move in a million different directions. Having said that, I want to arm you with some information about the lessons, and then you're free to, you know, go explore. For instance, starting with this passage in the book of Genesis. This is a very long and involved story. This is the story of a family, and it's kind of like the stories we tell about our families. You know, the colorful ones. Hey, Uncle Joe took Cousin Willie back behind the barn and beat the snot out of him because he was given Cousin Elizabeth a hard time for, you know, those kinds of stories. That's what Genesis is like. It's a family story. It's a story of a family on the move. It is a story of a family. It's a refugee family, please. We need to remember that. It is the story of a family in exile that has yet to find their place on the earth. And so they're traveling, they're moving, and their lives, everybody's life in these stories, is in jeopardy in one way or another, because they never quite know what's coming at them from one minute to the next. I mean, last week we heard about these strangers, and, you know, Abram jumps up and he serves them and he gets all hospitable, and Sarah's arguing with these guys. It turns out one of them's God, so she's arguing, and then here comes Hagar in this story, and the two women are going at it. I mean, this is a family, right? Sarah says to God, get rid of Hagar, get her out of here, I don't want this, whatever she is. The story describes her as a slave. Be careful with that. When you look at the Hebrew, she could have been a wife. She could have been a concubine of some kind among many, who knows, or a slave, as this particular translation describes her. But there's, you know, the women are going like this. One of them's got to go. Hagar and her son Ishmael end up out in the desert. God colludes on this, for crying out loud. But if you keep reading the story, which we will hear the next installment next week, the story of Abraham and Isaac, ringing any bells? We'll get to that next week. There's all kinds of wild stuff going on here. And again, all of these people in various ways, their lives are at risk because they're on the move, they're on the road, they're traveling, they're in exile, they are refugees. By God's invitation, okay? We'll come back to that at some point. And at the point at which Hagar, whose life is now seriously at risk, I mean, the water's run out, she's put her son Ishmael under a bush to die, and she cries out to God. Sarah's arguing with God. Hagar cries out to God. And even though these characters and these texts tend to minimize the role of the women, I mean, an example is when Abraham's concern, as the author tells us, revolves around his son. Oh yeah, thanks a lot, Bubba, says Hagar, you know, for the nod, right? But this is typical ancient misogynism, you know, where women were still considered chattel or property or whatever. Fine, file it by title, but there's a bigger and a deeper story going on here that's so important. Because once Hagar and her son Ishmael are seriously at risk, notice what the story says about the presence of God in this at-risk situation. Let me read it to you again. God says to Hagar, and God participates in this, "Come," he says to Hagar, "lift up the boy and hold him fast." Now, the reason that communities like ours get involved with families like we have just begun to resettle, the Afghani family that has just come into the U.S., and we're now in cahoots with the Mormons, the Catholics, the Methodists, the Buddhists, the Jewish community, I can't remember who else. I mean, we're now partnering with a number of faith communities. The reason we're doing this is because we want to be like God in this story. And as God is portrayed in all the stories in the Hebrew Scriptures and the Christian Scriptures, God lifts up refugees and holds them fast. And by gummies, we're going to do the same, right? I mean, that's our motivation. If we're going to be with God, then we want to be like God. So, and that's the deeper message, or at least one of the deeper messages of this family story in the book of Genesis. And you think this passage is weird, wait till we get to next Sunday and the story of Abraham and Isaac. And then we come to the gospel passage, the 10th chapter, Gospel according to Matthew. And as we discussed last week, it is absolutely vital. The only way you and I can understand any portion of Matthew's gospel or the gospel as a whole is to realize who these people are and when this story was written. Are you guys almost... Be careful with that fish. That's a prize. Yeah, Marietta said it smells bad. I don't smell it, but she does. Might be the glue or the materials that Devin used to make it. Who knows? Is that from the very beginning, I mean, the entire story of the Scriptures is the story of a people in exile from wall to wall, from the ancient stories starting in the book of Genesis, Exodus, right on through. I mean, the stories of the kings and chronicles, the prophets, they're all in exile. They're all being conquered. Thank you, Virginia. They're all being conquered. They're all being run over. They're all being... Pardon me? Well, you guys haven't seen it? Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's the story of exiles written by exiles and refugees. And there's no way to really get to the heart of the matter without that piece of information. So file that by title. And the teachings of Jesus that we heard today, from everything that we can gather from a biblical historical perspective, are really teachings that this author kind of pulled out of the air and put together in a particular way in order to make a point to this community of exiles, all of whose lives are at risk as of the writing of this story. And so, all of the stuff about father against mother and mother-in-law, you get the mother-in-law part better than the rest of it, don't you? You know, brother against sister, yeah. It's happening. It's already happening. Because Imperial Rome, as all imperial powers have done and continue to do, uses the tactic of dividing and conquering in order to maintain control and power in geographic area like the Palestine. And so they have successfully, at this point, at the end of the first century of the Common Era, long after the time of Jesus, they've ramped up their persecutions. These people are now being driven into poverty and martyrdom. And the author of Matthew's Gospel and the community of Matthew, they are already experiencing the kinds of divisions that are being described by Jesus in the story, as in the author is putting these words in the mouth of Jesus to try to unpack their current experience. How do we live with this? How do we navigate this? You know, our families are being torn asunder. Our villages, our towns, our crops, our livelihood, our economy, our political life, our religious institution. The temple has been destroyed in Jerusalem. Our lives are coming unraveled. How do we navigate this? What are we going to do? And they're already being divided and conquered yet again by Imperial Rome, and this is a reflection of life on the hoof. You see how that's... So, you know, all the stuff about unworthy, I mean... Yeah, on the one hand, you and I, we want to pay attention to the details because you never know what kind of nuggets we can extract from the story if we're paying attention to the details. But please understand the context. And the whole unworthy thing is directed towards a community that is experiencing a strife and whose lives are at risk in a way that you and I can't even imagine. Not even close. I mean, here we are in Carson, Douglas, Dayton, Washoe, Tahoe, Reno. We don't know what this life was like. I mean, we're not being put at risk. Well, not in the way this describes anyway. I mean, we have to use massive amounts of imagination to get a sense of what's really going on in these passages. So all this strident language, just be aware of the context in which it grew. And then we can file it by title. And oh, by the way, if you heard the comment I made earlier, there's probably all kinds of stuff in this passage that never came out of the mouth of Jesus. So again, And of course the question arises, well then, how do you know? Stick around. We'll get there. We got a whole summer to explore this stuff. But the bottom line is, if I can remember what the bottom line is that, again, with their lives at risk, their livelihoods are being destroyed, they're being set one against another. I mean, family members are being invited, probably paid off by Imperial Rome to rat each other out. These folks are being persecuted. They're being tortured. They're being killed. They're being crucified. And all for the peace of Rome. oh yeah, we're going to establish peace, says Rome, and you may have to die for it in the meantime. They're asking themselves enormous questions. And here's some examples of the questions. They're asking, from the vantage point of Matthew's gospel, who are we? We're a bunch of Jewish folk, and you know, we used to have a synagogue, and that's at risk, and we used to have the temple, and now we don't, and now we've attached ourselves to Jesus. We're not even quite sure what that means yet, but we really love the stories about him. I mean, you know, blessed are the poor in spirit, love your enemies. Yeah, we're all behind this, but who are we? How's this going to work? Especially as we're being sliced and diced. Next question, who is our leader? Who is our guide? Who do we follow? Yeah, the easy answer is Jesus, but what does that mean living in a war zone? How do you pull this off? And especially when you get to the heart of Jesus' teaching, which I'm about to share with you in a minute. This is a, you know, how do we navigate this is a huge question back then. What is our purpose? Why are we here? Why are we doing what we do? We could be asking ourselves the same question. And finally, who is part of our community, who is not, and how do we tell the difference? Again, think war zone, persecution, martyrdom, crucifixion. Okay? These are big questions. And all in light of the core of Jesus' teaching in the gospel according to Matthew. Now, I'm going to throw this at you. I am not going to help you with it today. This is something I would invite you to contemplate and hold, ponder in your heart, as the story would say, because this is a tough one to unpack. The invitation of Jesus, I mean, when he's talking about following me, taking up your cross, and those who lose their lives will save it, translates like this. Jesus invites his friends and his followers to live a life of non-resistance to violence. Let me say that again. He invites any who would follow him to live a life of non-resistance to violence, and at the same time, and here's where it gets sticky, he also invites those who would follow to live lives of nonviolent resistance. Don't try to work it too hard. You'll hurt your head. It hurts mine when I do this. So we're going to take our time with this. Non-resistance to violence and nonviolent resistance. And if you want to understand the image of the cross in the gospel according to Matthew, you come at it from these two points of view. Non-resistance to violence and nonviolent, almost opposite ends of the spectrum, and where they converge is the cross. I'm going to leave it there. We got all summer. But with those two divergent invitations and how difficult it is to even imagine living life on that spectrum, now we can begin to understand why the ancient ones in Matthew's community were asking the questions that they were asking. You know, how are we going to pull this off? Part of the answer, and I hate to bring it up because it's almost too obvious, is by the grace of God. And so, as we once again gather here to align ourselves with God, to imagine what it would be like for us to take up this invitation and this challenge, to live lives of non-resistance to violence and non-violent resistance, we pray. We pray. So, let's. Take a nice deep breath.